On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk.
Now, yesterday in New York, Taoiseach Micheál Martin said he's open to giving vaccines to over fives after Pfizer developed a vaccine it says is safe and highly effective after clinical trials. It comes as contact tracing rules for primary schools change from tomorrow and mandatory hotel quarantine has come to an end. And with the budget looming, there's plenty in the papers today highlighting areas that need proper state investment, including child and youth mental health services, the future of direct provision and the staggering cost of childcare. So it's a busy time if you are the Minister for Children, Equality, Disability, Integration and Youth, who is, of course, Roderick O'Gorman, who joins me now. Minister O'Gorman, good afternoon.
Hi, Sean. Thanks for having me on the show.
Thanks for joining us. We might start with that news from New York and the Taoiseach saying there is a plan or will be a plan to vaccinate over fives. What can you tell us about it at the moment?
Well, look, we're seeing now that some of the companies developing vaccines are now looking are undertaking testing on vaccines for younger children. Look, I think that's a significant development. We've seen a very successful uptake of the vaccine here on the 12 to 15 year olds. So should this vaccine complete clinical trials, it'll obviously be reviewed by the European authorities and the authorities here. And again, subject to the approval, it's definitely something we'd look at rolling out here in Ireland.
What's the percentage on the 12 to 15s at the minute?
I think I don't have the exact on the 12 to 15 right now, Sean, but I know it's been extremely successful. I think there was maybe a little bit of hesitancy at the start, but the take up there has been really successful, as it has been on all rates going into 16 plus.
That's more what I was wondering, because we obviously talked at the start of this about whether that hesitancy would be there, whether people who got it as an adult would be more reticent about giving it to children. And do you think that'll kick in a little bit more maybe with younger children, that we tend to mind a bit more?
Well, look, I think it's possible, and I think it's really important to say that this will be a decision for parents to take in the final instance. Obviously, as we know, we vaccinate children under 12 for a very significant number of serious illnesses in their youth, that's been incredibly successful in Ireland. And again, Ireland has really high uptakes of the kind of the general vaccinations, the MMRs and that. So, look, I think if we bring in a scheme like this, I do think parents would welcome it. But again, all additional vaccination programs are subject to the public health advice.
What kind of timescale are we looking at on that? Because obviously Pfizer has only just come out and announced that. I presume it has to go through the European Medicines Agency the same way that they have before, and then NIAC and HSE and all that. So what timescale would you expect?
Yeah, well, I suppose it initially depends on Pfizer in terms of their completing clinical trials and bringing those results to the various public health agencies. So I imagine it would be a number of months away in terms of before the Irish and European health authorities would be making final determinations on the usability of that particular vaccine.
This side of Christmas, would you expect?
Again, it's very much dependent on Pfizer and the completion of their own trial. So I wouldn't speculate on terms of specific dates.
Could you see a situation? Obviously, we've had people going into vaccination centres, including the 12 to 15s. But where could you see a situation where this becomes something that is done in schools for those younger age groups, the way some of the other vaccines for different diseases have in the past?
Well, look, I suppose a lot of it depends on the wider move of COVID across the community, and we're kind of moving from this pandemic to a more endemic stage of COVID, where there will probably be an amount of COVID across the community at all times. And then I suppose decisions will have to be made in terms of, like the flu, do we do an annual vaccination shot, and to which particular groups is that annual vaccination shot offered to? So I think, you know, you mentioned obviously the removal of a lot of restrictions there. We are returning to normality, and I think it'll be, I suppose, a kind of a wider, higher level view will have to be taken in terms of how is COVID treated as a kind of a ongoing public health issue, but not the sort of threat that it has posed over the last 18 months.
Yeah, it does certainly, particularly with mandatory hotel quarantine going. We'll get into contact tracing in a minute. There does feel an element around at the minute that, okay, we're done here, COVID is over. Is that the sort of sense around cabinet, or do we still need to be cautious?
I wouldn't say a sense of we're done, but a certain sense of a return to normality in a structured way, a gradual relaxing of some of the final restrictions, some of the final procedures, but you know, still a recognition that in various parts, particularly of the economy and of society, the impact of COVID doesn't just abruptly stop on the 22nd of October, and supports, whether it's financial supports in terms of the EWSS or additional health supports in terms of the investment in the HSE services, particularly trying to deal with the various backlogs that have built up in areas. There's an understanding in COVID that it's not just going to stop abruptly, and the consequences of the last 18 months will have to continue to be managed.
Just finally on the vaccines, there is obviously an ethical question here as well. It's been raised by Luke O'Neill and others on this station that really, should we be vaccinating children who are largely unaffected by the virus, it must be said, or giving booster shots when there are healthcare workers in more developing parts of the world who have got no vaccine or no sight of a vaccine yet?
No, and I think that is a really important point. There's an ethical question there. There's also a public health question in terms of if COVID continues to run kind of uncontained in third world countries, then there is a risk that further variants develop, which then has consequences for the entire world. I know Ireland, Minister Donnelly informed Cabinet a number of weeks ago in terms of a very significant donation of, I think, about 1 million vaccines to the COVAX program, as well on top of additional supports we've put in place there. And I know the Taoiseach was engaging with the Prime Minister of Vietnam, and that country reached out in terms of the difficulties it's facing in terms of locating sufficient vaccines. So look, I think we are taking a strong role in Europe in terms of providing additional vaccines for the COVAX program, but we do need to continue that, both from that kind of ethical and that public health perspective.
So you think there is room to do both?
I think, yes, no, absolutely, I think there is.
Okay. Obviously, contact tracing rules for primary schools are changing tomorrow. It could be a little hard to wrap your head around. So who can and can't go back to school tomorrow?
Well, the key change is that when a child 12 and under has a close contact, but that close contact isn't from their household, and that child isn't asymptomatic, that child won't need to restrict his or her movement. So he or she will be able to go back to school. It only becomes an issue if a close contact is from a child's household, or if the child is showing symptoms of COVID, in which case they should restrict their movements and contact their GP.
Okay, and what about the likes of socialising, sleepovers and etc. if you're close contact?
Yeah, no, the HSE said that if a kid was doing a sleepover in the house and that household has a close contact, that child then does have to be treated as a close contact, and the rules as regards restricting movements applies there.
Okay, and is the thinking behind this that it is more out there in the community than it is in schools, or is it more on a recognition that, look, children have missed a lot of school time, we need to keep that open, even if it does mean we're not contact tracing everything?
Yeah, well, look, it's advice from NPHET in terms of this quite significant change. And I think it is primarily driven by the fact, a recognition that, you know, rates in schools and in childcare facilities are low. I know since September in childcare facilities, the positivity rate has been 4%. And last week it was down as far as 3%. But I think primarily we know children, we know COVID has been very hard on children and young people, particularly the large amounts of school missed last year and the start of this year, and where children coming back now in September are missing kind of chunks of 10 days on the basis of being a close contact, even though and subsequently they're not asymptomatic and they don't have COVID themselves. That's a further disruption. So I think the changes are being made in recognition of the fact that we want to allow children and young people enjoy the benefits of, I suppose, the much improved public health situation.
Moving on to some of the other issues in the brief, and there are quite a few issues. You're a busy man at the moment, it has to be said. The Sunday Independent today, consultant psychiatrist Dr. Yvonne Begley is talking about the Child and Adolescent Mental Health Services, CAMHS, which we know for years has had difficulties, has been underfunded, has a long waiting list. There were more than 2,700 people on a waiting list earlier this year. And it feels like something we talk about every year without a huge amount of progress being made. So is there going to be a significant package for youth mental health in this budget that is actually going to make a difference?
Well, look, there was a big increase in youth mental health budget last year. There was an additional 50 million into mental health, bringing it up to 1.1 billion, which is extremely significant. I think the big issue this year, there's been delays in hiring additional staff and that those key clinical posts. And I think that's been experienced in a lot of areas in the HSC outside of the immediate response to COVID. And I think that's what I was speaking about earlier, in terms of the government looking to respond now as COVID becomes less of an issue. We have to get back to dealing with the existing issues in the health service. So I know in August of this year, a 4 million package was approved, specifically targeted at reducing the number of children and young people under 18 on the primary care psychology waiting lists. And I know there's a significant hiring campaign going on for additional mental health staff. I think about 150 additional mental health staff at the moment. And I know a significant number of those will be posted directly into the CAMHS services. So look, I think we're very clear that adolescent and youth mental health services were under pressure before COVID. COVID hasn't obviously improved that situation at all. And now as we move out of COVID, we really have to look to get the staff levels up there so we can deliver these key services for vulnerable young people.
And what's been the problem with recruiting those 150 people? Why are the jobs not filled?
I think, I suppose, that just the key issue is that so much of the HSE's focus has been on the issue of dealing with COVID over the last number of months. And then, of course, the cyber attack over the summer, it didn't help the issue either.
Okay. Moving to another big issue for people, particularly as this week a lot of people return to the office and we're all kind of weighing up, are we going to work from home? Are we going to work from the office? Is it going to be a bit of both? And for anyone with children, childcare obviously plays a big factor in that, and the rising cost of it has been something that's been going on for a long time. I know you've talked in the past about, or certainly the department has talked about, state-funded and state-backed childcare. Where are we, and where, particularly as you look to the budget, because this is something that will cost a big chunk of change, where are we on that, and what can people who are paying what is essentially a second mortgage expect to see next month?
Yeah, well, look, childcare is my number one priority in the budget negotiations this year. And there's major issues there in terms of affordability for parents, in terms of pay, the pay level that childcare professionals get, and the sustainability of services around the country. And all three of those issues are interlinked. We already put 638 million into childcare each year, but compared to other European countries, that is quite a small amount. So as we put additional funding in, and that's my commitment to do that, we have to make sure that we're delivering on making it more affordable for parents, ensuring that our childcare professionals are being paid properly, and ensuring that services are sustainable and that they can operate. We've had an expert group on the looking at how we fund childcare over the last 2 years. They're bringing forward their recommendations to me in November of this year, but we have a sense of some of the key parts of those, and they're very much my bid on, in terms of the budgetary process, is very much designed in terms of responding to the findings of the expert group.
What kind of a level of funding are you looking at? Because there's briefing notes from your department last year that said if you were to provide a fully state-back system, it would cost 2 billion euro a year. It's obviously a significant step up from the 600 odd million you've just outlined. So will we get that in one budget, or realistically, is this a number of year process?
Yeah, I think it is realistically something that would be built up over a number of years. I think the government commitment is that by 2028 we'll have doubled the investment in childcare, and that will bring us to well over a billion euro.
Still a long way off the 2 billion euro that your department was quoting, though.
Well, I think that's in terms of a full takeover of all childcare services in the country. And I think what we're looking at is to, I suppose, try and take away this marketisation of childcare, where, as you commented earlier on, over a number of years, we were seeing this continuous increase in the annual fees that parents were paying. So what we're doing is making sure that any additional funding that we put into the sector is very much linked to a set of conditions in terms of around fees, in terms of around the pay that the childcare professionals receive.
So would you think after this budget, people who are paying for childcare will be able to see a drop in what they're paying every month?
Look, I think we're right in the middle of these discussions right now, and I've engaged significantly with Minister McGrath. I know he's particularly interested in addressing this issue. So look, I don't want to prejudge those, but I think, you know, the issues of affordability and that constant increase in fees, that issue of the sustainability of services, and ensuring that the level of pay for our childcare professionals who've done amazing work across COVID is fair and gives them a future in that particular profession. Those are my objectives in these budget negotiations.
In terms of those childcare staff you were talking about, one of the issues that came up during the week was that if a member of staff in some creche, not all, but some creche facilities couldn't work as they were a close contact, they wouldn't get paid. That's really not good enough, is it?
No, it's not. It's not, and instances like that, which are rare, but it does it undermines the confidence of childcare professionals that they have a future in childcare, and I think we know we are losing staff. In the area of staff who've, you know, spent three or four years going to college training and getting real qualifications, and then feeling that there isn't a future for them in the sector. We've been working on a workforce planning approach, which kind of sets out clear. I suppose, progressions in terms of advancing your career in childcare. But that will also require that additional state investment to make sure that people are paid to an amount that recognises the work that they're doing. As you know, earlier in this year, I helped set up a joint labour committee between the unions representing childcare workers and the employers, and that will be hopefully bring forward a recommendation in terms of pay scales in the next number of months. I think that's a significant step forward in recognising the need of childcare professionals to be paid appropriately.
Putting your Green Party minister hat on for a second, a very worrying report in the Business Post this morning. Daniel Murray has the story, has seen some of AirGrid's report, which is due to come out this week, and it's due to warn that it won't be possible in the coming years to secure enough new energy to meet rising demand. People obviously have seen their electricity bills going up. We have more announcements during the week and potential for blackouts, even though Eamon Ryan has said there won't be this winter. This is a huge crisis already affecting us, but coming down the line, what can be done to intervene? What are you going to do?
Yeah, well, look, it's something that Eamon has been flagging for a number of months, and I think in terms of the immediate issue, in terms of the spike in the cost of energy, I think, you know, Eamon is making proposals in terms of this budget to shield more customers from those particular spikes. I think there's also issues in terms of the short term supply. Two of our significant gas fired stations were out of action. They'll hopefully be back in action at the start of the winter. There was the fire in the French UK interconnector, which limited the amount of supply there. And there's geopolitics in this as well, in terms of Russia reducing the supply of gas from its gas fields. But I think there's wider issues we can look at as well. And in terms of our decarbonisation of the our energy supply, in the next number of years, a significant number of these solar power plants will be coming online. We are passing the marine planning bill in this Dáil term, which will allow much greater use of offshore wind. And look, these are issues that are being faced by a lot of European countries. Germany is facing something similar as it moves away from coal and nuclear. But I know that the Commission for the Regulation of Utilities will be bringing forward a plan in the next number of weeks, specifically to ensure that we have adequate supply of energy going into this winter.
Okay, there's a much broader chat we could have there, but time is starting to come up against us, and I do want to ask you about direct provision, because it was one of the big things, obviously, in your manifesto for the Green Party and for you yourself when you came into this ministry. Documents released to the Irish Times recently show that some of your officials in the department believe that actually directly buying direct provision centres and having the state run them instead of this private system that's there at the minute is the best approach and perhaps the most efficient approach to go about ending direct provision, or certainly the system that's there at the minute. Do you agree with that?
Well, that's not too far away from what we've done in the white paper that I brought forward in February this year, which basically calls for an end to the current system of direct provision and an end from relying on the private sector to supply accommodation. And that from going forward, it will be the state and the state working with approved housing bodies and NGOs who will deliver the accommodation. So that document was suggesting kind of buying existing direct provision centres. Our major focus is going to be on buying and building accommodation in the community and also then providing six reception and integration centres where when people first arrive, which will have kind of wraparound health and education, childcare services.
But would buying those existing
help people initially?
Would buying those existing ones and perhaps doing them up be a more efficient way? Because obviously the problem you're facing is the problem a lot of people are facing, is that there is a housing shortage.
Well, look, I think we'll look at all options in terms of whether it's procurement or whether it's whether it's building. I think all options are on the table. But obviously, you made the key point there. It's suitability, and I think we know a lot of the existing direct provision centres aren't suitable in terms of not providing own door accommodation, not providing somewhere for people to live where they can live with dignity, and that's the key reason that we're ending direct provision. But we also announced this week that the new advisory group, we were appointing Catherine Day, David Donoghue and Laura Conser to oversee the implementation of the white paper. And obviously they've huge expertise in terms of international humanitarian law, direct provision itself and housing and all of those areas. That sort of expertise is going to be really important in ensuring that kind of my department and all the other relevant departments meet our targets in terms of ending direct provision by 2024.
Okay. Minister for Children, Equality, Disability, Integration and Youth, Roderick O'Gorman, thanks for joining us on The Record this afternoon. Plenty to keep you busy in your brief as we head into the budget.